Welcome to On the Brink Radio number 308. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson recording the show from the town of Takaka in the Golden Bay area of the South Island of New Zealand. It's the Friday, the I think today's the 18th or 19th of January 2020. Today's show is partly covering the Australian bushfire scenario that I've covered in the last several shows, and also introducing a new concept that I've just made up, an extension on my concept of geoterrorism that I invented in the wake of the Christchurch quakes in Fukushima in 2011. This is called heliogeoterrorism. H-E-L-I-O, that's the Greek word for the sun, helios. So it doesn't mean necessarily using the sun as a weapon, but in the same way that geoterrorism refers to geo meaning having to do with the earth, that comes from the Greek root Gaia, helios means the sun. So heliogeoterrorism means the engineering of natural processes and events and occurrences and energies, the manipulation and experimentation and weaponization of them, not only energies of the earth, the earth's lithosphere, magnetosphere, ionosphere, and atmosphere, but also the energies and emanations of the sun and the what we call the heliocosm, which is the whole area surrounding the sun. Really, heliocosm is kind of synonymous with the solar system, but it kind of implies the area, the closer to you, to the sun that you are, the greater the heliocosmic influences. For example, the Earth would be hit by a lot more high energy particles from the solar wind than would Saturn or Jupiter. But everything, all the objects and bodies in the solar system do have massive amounts of energy coming from the sun. I'd really like to thank Dr. Claudia von Werloff for reposting my article and show, Australia Under Fire, Environmental Warfare and the Climate Change Deception, in her newsletter. So this is getting a lot of international exposure right now. And Claudia said that she reckons that the first responses to that are starting to come in, and that it's going to be really hard to maintain the carbon dioxide hoax. But I countered by saying that I think that the spin doctors and the whole propaganda apparatus that we're up against, it's been going, this is their biggest project ever since MK Ultra and everything they've learned all through the 20th century, the Weltanschauungskrieg and worldview warfare, all the advertising and marketing and experimental psychological operations. But the big lie writ large, but who knows what they're going to try to spin. You know, they're going to, clearly we're already knee deep in the, oh look, we told you so, this is the climate emergency that we told you about, Australia must now sign over its sovereignty to the United Nations and get some leaders in there that'll care about the earth, and they, maybe they'll be young attractive women that'll save Australia from climate change. It's all just an unbelievable crock. But yeah, everybody's crying climate change, and I haven't even it's actually only coming out now, sort of like every other article that you see is about that. But what I'm saying is, I've thought of several different aspects to this whole thing. One of them could be that the people, organizations, think tanks behind this geophysical operation, one of the things that they might be planning as part of the future of Australia, but also for the Earth in general, is the introduction or release of different kinds of custom-made, genetically modified organisms. And I'm saying this not only half in jest, it's so horrific to think about, but in the same way that Monsanto created, I think it was corn or wheat or corn, or different kind of crops that are resistant to Roundup. So therefore, they can soak up all the Roundup that there is, but it won't kill them. But Roundup kills everything else. But they've probably made organisms that are fire and drought resistant, like fire resistant marsupials and drought resistant trees and crops that can survive with no water, or that can survive fires without getting burned, they'll heal really fast, or some kind of really weird Frankenstein animals and plants that, I mean, you know, they're probably working on this. They probably have it already. They think that, and this is probably like some of the stuff that Elon Musk plans to release on Mars. And I've taken the piss on Elon Musk quite a bit, but I don't think it's undeserved. But I'm not making up all the stuff about his planned mission to Mars and all the stuff. And, you know, I want to see him get through the Van Allen radiation belts myself and see what Wernher von Braun would have had to say about that. But anyway, the possibility of genetically modified organisms being released in Australia, you know, to fill the niches for all the biologically flawed, poor little, genuinely alive living beings that have lived successfully in Australia for hundreds of millions of years, many of them completely wiped out and hopefully not have been completely extincted. But there's no way to know, and it's just so horrific. I've been really sad because my last two shows are two of my most very important ones. The one, Australia Under Fire, and then Calling All Kingdoms, in honor of all my family of life that's in pain and suffering and been so many of them killed and burned to death, still ongoing. Both of these shows got very low open rates, like only 10 or 12%. And so that's very sad. Very sad indeed. But at least, like I said, it's not the quantity of people that I reach, it's the quality. So for William Ingdahl and Claudia von Werloff to have responded so enthusiastically, they're huge, huge readerships in the world. Very influential, aware, leading-edge minds. Another aspect to the technological dimension that I really didn't have a chance to go into. I did go into a good bit of detail about the, you know, sort of speculative looks at the strategic, tactical, and theater level deployments of the different kind of ionospheric heaters and directed energy technologies and pulsed microwave weapons and stuff like that, and how it might be being used in the different ways that the weather and firestorms seem to be being modified and manipulated and literally aimed and directed, almost as if somebody or something was right there watching at every sort of small little town and stuff like that. It was being constantly sort of steered or driven according to what was happening. And this is completely capable of being done by artificial intelligence. That I think all this weather warfare operations are essentially done by artificial intelligence. It's way too complex, way too much information coming in real time, just like a nuclear war or any kind of thing. It can only be successfully managed with computers that are able to process all this information with sensors, satellites, cameras, all this information feeding back in real time. And then they probably need the ability to sort of visualize what's going on. Like, for example, these people that have reported giant fireballs hurling out from the fire front, like right at them, and fires changing direction, sort of turning around and coming right back at the people, and the unprecedented speed at which they've moved, like covering 20 or 30 kilometers just in 4 or 5 hours. I mean, this is all unheard of. And so I'm actually asking my friends, there's a guy named Dave Brook that's got a Facebook page called Weather Anomalies Australia. I'm going to ask people on there if anyone has the time to sort of go through all the literature and compile a documented, collated list of all the anomalous things that people have reported, whether it's people evacuating or fighting the fires or the firefighters themselves, And well, I've already seen dozens of instances of people just going like they've never seen anything like this, and sort of catalog what all that is and start looking for some patterns in that. That's going to tell a lot of the story that we already know. So we've got the possible post-incendiary introduction of genetically modified organisms and life forms. We already know Australia is rampant with genetically engineered, like, cotton and corn, canola, and also genetically engineered eucalyptus tree plantations. So who knows what's on the drawing board for what's going to happen with all this land that is not going to be able to be reclaimed by the people that owned it. And again, that's another huge area of inquiry here. We've also got the concept that relates to the GMO thing that you might call what's going on incendiary terraforming, which is like terraforming, you know, terra means the earth, but it originally came into vogue when, for example, I'm not sure who first used the term. It might have actually been a science fiction writer, but I remember back in the 1960s, father of the hydrogen bomb, Edward Teller, had the idea of using a nuclear explosive device to blast a new harbor up in Alaska. And luckily that got shot down. And there was other ideas where people have had sort of harebrained ideas to do a similar type thing. And then there was, of course, like, this is stuff that would be hard to get away with down at the level of where people are, even in remote areas, because an atomic detonation couldn't be pulled off secretly. But in the atmosphere, it could, and therefore they were able to do Project Argus back in 1958, where they detonated 3 hydrogen bombs in the Van Allen radiation belts. And it was part of an experiment where this guy named Dr. Christofilos, a Greek scientist, had already understood the conjugate, geomagnetic conjugate concept and knew that if they created a rain of charged particles in a certain area, then they would come down on the exact opposite side of the earth, creating a rain of charged particles. And this, although in the article that I read, they talk about how it would be used as a shield against what, I'm not sure, nuclear missiles, but the main idea is that if you're going to rain down charged particles somewhere, that could easily be a weapon. I mean, it's probably going to be far more dangerous than it is that it can help anything. I mean, if you just think about it. So we've got genetically modified organism release, artificial intelligence, automated environmental modification, automated in-mod, weather warfare handled by computers, which we sort of already knew that was the case. We've got incendiary terraforming. And we've got a new thing that I just realized with Rupert Murdoch and how huge and influential this person is and his pretty much lockdown stranglehold on the mass media of Australia and a lot of larger stuff in the world, that he could be involved with this whole thing at the level of capitalizing on a form of disaster capitalism, not on land grabs, but on marketing the imagery of destruction, the drama, the horror, the terror, the ecological devastation, like a giant whole new wave, a new paradigm of reality TV based on these whole fire situation in Australia. And it's almost like it was so blown out of proportion with the horror, how big and fast the fires were, how intense, and melting cars and killing everything and all the fleeing animals and the smoke, the people waking up midnight at dawn, and just every aspect of it. It's not, you know, even if all this stuff is exactly, it happened as they reported it, it's still, the one thing you know, notice is that in almost every media report, it seems to be exaggerated to a degree. I know that whenever I've rung and talked with my friends in Australia, which I've done, 2 or 3 dozen times over the past month to check up on where they are and what's happening where they are, it always ends up sounding like that it's not quite as bad where they are as the media has made it out to be. So I think that in the same way that the adage for journalism used to be, if it bleeds, it leads. And then with these fires, it's became, if it burns, it earns. I think I used that in an earlier show. So I think Rupert Murdoch and probably other media moguls are capitalizing on this heavily, probably planning all kinds of reality TV shows, interviews with the firefighters, interviews with these families, all kind of whole series of documentary films and probably whole TV series, fiction drama based on the Bush fires, you know, TV series based on the firefighters, the whole docudramas about the climate change deniers that are in office now, and all this just the morass of conflicting conceptual ideologies, but all with a lot of drama and spin enough to just make it spectacular entertainment for consumption by the public. And so that you've got the underlying thing of the whole climate change deception behind all this. So I was trying to determine where Rupert Murdoch is perceived to stand on this, and apparently he's, quote unquote, he's in the same denier category as all the leadership of Australia, you know, so for whatever that's worth. But I think the bottom line is, however people can make the most money, that's their bottom line. It doesn't matter what they believe or what they pretend to believe or what anybody else thinks they believe, or how evil they might seem, or how good, or both, or what they're doing. I think if they can all just capitalize on making the most money as possible, that's still the bottom line with all this stuff. Al Gore made his billions of dollars on selling climate credits. Carbon credits. I'm still not sure how that works. And I'm in a country now that has declared zero tolerance for carbon. And so it's literally a morass of insanity, because zero carbon, of course, means zero life. And so it's just really, really insane. So, but this show is called Heliogeoterrorism, and it's about a lot of interesting stuff that seems to be happening at the geo-heliocosmic level right now, in terms of, like, for example, in the show from 2 weeks ago, I talked about how right around the time these fires were just raging out of control, like at Malacuta, there was this Earth Observatory in northern Norway near Lofoten, and they detected an unprecedented giant surge of electricity coming out of the ground. And of course, the scientists attributed it to some kind of energy outburst coming from the sun that ripped the magnetic field or the solar wind, you know, or something like that. Of course, a natural event. But it was interesting because not only because of when this was happening, but because that it was unprecedented, it was new. The scientists that had been studying all this stuff for many years said he had never seen anything like this. So I wrote about it, and then I started looking into the geomagnetic conjugate thing and saw that the geomagnetic conjugate point for Tromsø, which is a major ionospheric heater only 102 kilometers from Lofoten, it's called ISCAT, E-I-S-C-A-T. The geomagnetic conjugate point for that is a Chinese geophysical ionospheric heater installation in Antarctica. And I thought that was very interesting. Well, anyway, now 2 weeks later, I see that there's been an explosion in the Earth's magnetic field. And again, even though the first big example of this new type of explosion in the Earth's magnetic field, the one that they were particularly, that brought this to their radar, happened in 2015, studied by a UCLA geophysicist named Vasilis Angelopoulos, another Greek dude. Very interesting. And he happens to be at the same or associated laboratory at UCLA that the legendary father of geophysical warfare, Gordon J.F. McDonald, worked at. And it's also important to note that the UCLA Plasma Physics Laboratory operates the predecessor of HARP in Alaska. It's called High Pass, the high-powered auroral stimulation installation. Rosalie Bertel has written about that quite a bit. So anyway, all this stuff has been in existence for a long time. All these people know each other. They work for research departments at universities. But this explosion in the Earth's magnetic field, this guy was studying it and talking about the amount of energy that was released. Angelopoulos estimated the energy involved. I'm reading from the article. The explosion and subsequent storm delivered as much as 88 petajoules of energy to the near-Earth environment. That's more than 10 times the energy of the largest nuclear U.S. nuclear bomb and about 20 times the energy of a magnitude 7 earthquake. So now this is straight out of Gordon MacDonald, because his central tenet for geophysical warfare of any type, whether you want to deal with droughts, fires, storms, earthquakes, cyclones, anything like that, the key is identifying processes or regions in the Earth's natural structures, whether it's atmospheric, lithospheric, hydrospheric, atmospheric, ionospheric. There's regions that store vast amounts of energy so that you can trigger the release of these vast amounts of energy and therefore attain energy levels that are impossible to attain through anything that people can do. For example, MacDonald said something like that the typical and average thunderstorm contains more energy, I guess if you want to measure it in petajoules or maybe BTUs or something like that, one of these units. The typical thunderstorm, just an average one, contains far more firepower than the entire arsenal of every nuclear weapon that exists. So all your weapons, weaponization specialists would have always salivated over this whole thing, you know. How do we harness this energy? How do we get it under our control? How do we make it do what we want to do? How do we enslave it, or we got to capture it, or we've got to trick it into, we got to put some bait in this cage and it'll go in there and we'll slam the door shut and we'll catch this, a bunch of helioplasmic energies coming out, and then we won't feed it for a while, and then we'll make it work for us, you know. So like I was saying, all this stuff, it's very science fiction sounding. But it's actually beyond science fiction, because this is the real world. You know, I've read a lot of what I consider to be the very best science fiction in the world. And it's my favorite genre of film and literature. But the real world is far freakier. Always has been, always will be. All the media people are talking about how this is very, you keep seeing the word apocalyptic with what's happening in Australia. It's apocalyptic. It's like the end of the world. It's like doomsday and all this kind of stuff. And I think there's a lot of different tie-ins here. Part of it is that the archetype of fire and burning is a huge one in the human psyche. And we've used fire to help us survive, or at least we think we've needed fire to survive in order to stay warm, to stave off bogeymen in the dark, and to cook food. We think of having captured and controlled fire as essential for, I guess, civilization. But I mean, I don't know. I think that that's probably an incorrect thing to say, because humans have used fire. I don't know this for sure, but I believe that we've used fire long before civilization per se, when we started digging precious things from the land and then living in cities, which were really forts and violating the Hopi prophecy. So I'm not sure where the Hopi elders stand about the use of fire, because if you think about it, humans would be the only life forms that use fire. For sure. And so how far back that goes, that could have been an early step towards the process of domestication that seems to have been leading to the current cul-de-sac of mutated devolution that we find ourselves in right now. Domestication of ourselves that's been going on possibly since the dawn of using fire. But when you think about the whales and dolphins, for example, about how they truly are the ultimate indigenous people, and a true extraterrestrial intelligence, they've never had fire. They've never had hands, or if they did, it was so long ago before they returned to the ocean. They've never had fire, they've never cooked their food, they've never brushed their teeth, they've never had hands. They don't manipulate the external world to any degree like we do. I mean, sure, they can pick up a fish or a rock or a shell or a leaf with their mouth. They can do things like that, but they're not all about manipulating the external world. But the specter of destruction by fire is probably something that's deeply ingrained in our collective memory and would be associated with. Emmanuel Velikovsky writes about the catastrophism that has plagued our ancestors ever since we've been here, as far back as we can remember, and I think it goes into the collective consciousness that spans just human consciousness, the whales and dolphins, and every life form would have in its genetic memory stored information about giant cataclysms that the Earth has experienced resulting from an impact with a comet or asteroid, or maybe one passing by really close that caused gravitational perturbations. Maybe we passed through the tail of a comet and had all kinds of debris coming down, gaseous emissions, poison, toxic clouds, maybe even manna from heaven, like Velikovsky says, that came down. All this stuff is possible. But his main hypothesis was that the overall consequences of these repeated catastrophic planetary events have traumatized us psychically, so that we're actually behaving as psychiatric patients who are in complete denial and repression of these ancient memories of almost being destroyed to extinction many times over, but we refuse to remember it. And so therefore, that's dooming us to act out our own self-destruction through the process of attempting to emulate the gods, emulating the gods that had the power to destroy us so many times over with bolts of lightning from the heavens and electrical discharges between planets and all kinds of cometary bodies moving to and fro in the sky, many, many more, a much higher density in the possibly not that distant past than we are now, that even Duncan Steele, when I was interviewing him a couple of weeks ago, he said that he believed that the heavens of the not that distant past were quite different. And I said, maybe the planets were in a different place. And he goes, no, it was sort of maybe different kind of things, like the what we call the Gegenschein, similar to the zodiacal light. It's like a band or an arc of luminous. It's actually reflected from particles that are in orbit around the Earth or around the Sun. But it's like arcs of light that you can see in the sky. And it would probably look kind of like the Milky Way, but a different shape and in a different place. And so, you know, there's all kind of possibilities of what our ancestors have gone through. And the whales and dolphins experience and all and remember all this stuff and have been trying to tell us about what's happened. This is a really big thing that I feel has been happening with me for a long time, that they're psychically transmitting, not just to me, but to anybody. I'm one of the few people that can actually pick up on it and make sense out of their information. But they witnessed catastrophic celestial events, like a comet or asteroid impact, and are trying to tell us that not only that this has happened before and possibly when, but also that something like this is getting ready to happen again. And I've speculated a lot and working on writing in much greater detail about how they might know this through their intimate connection with water, which has very unique properties as the most unique element, substance that exists. And they live in a giant spherical shell of water we call Mother Ocean. And so I think that the ocean can act as sort of like a vibratory antenna, not only for water-based life, but for all kinds of vibrations and events and processes and objects that are in the heliocosm, in the solar system. So I think that they have ways of detecting, of listening or feeling or hearing what's happening in the sun, what's happening with the different planets, what else there might be that's coming, what it might be doing, and what's happened before. This is a really big part of I think where I'm able to get a lot of these ideas and information from right now, and guiding me on how to understand what's happening with what my fellow humans are doing in terms of geophysical warfare. But I think that we see these Australian fires, and it does conjure up memories of conflagrations, planetary-wide conflagrations that might have accompanied asteroid or cometary impacts, and what we call ELEs, extinction level events. This is not one. Well, maybe on a scale, a more localized scale. Hopefully it's not, but it could be sort of a small scale version of an extinction level event. Hopefully not for any species, but this is a foreshadowing or an omen or an echo of this kind of thing that both has happened and it is probably going to happen again soon on a much bigger scale, fulfilling what Hopi elder Thomas Banyaka, the Hopi prophecy, calls the day of purification. And Bielakowski talks about, he calls it cataclysmic evolution, although cataclysm technically in Greek only refers to destruction by water. So it should more accurately be called catastrophic evolution. But he points out that we can't just look at the evolution of life and how it's changed and how new life forms have come into being. We can't just look at that in terms of the Darwinian idea of uniformitarian, a very slow process that's the same, and it just changes so slowly we can't really tell. But even that doesn't really explain where new species come from. But Bielakowski said that this long, slow, uniformitarian movement has been punctuated numerous, if not innumerable, times in the history of life on Earth to create episodes of cataclysmic evolution where relatively suddenly, if not instantaneously in terms of geological time, the whole face of the Earth and all of life has just been nearly completely eradicated and terminated by, we geologists talk about the five major mass extinction events, but there's been probably many more on a smaller scale. And again, these are just sort of models that are based on second and third hand deductive information gathering from ice core samples and fossil records and stuff, and there's not really very much of that actual information. If you took the time and realized how little of this information there actually is and how great the extrapolation is to create these models and these sweeping theories, it's a bit tenuous of a connection, really. But it's really all we've got, other than unless we decide we want to access our actual memories. But more into more recent times, we've got what I call the Atlantean discontinuity, where the quasi-mythological continent or country or land of Atlantis was destroyed. The legend says that it sank, but we're not sure why. But in Nick Begich and Gene Manning's brilliant book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, which is about the High Altitude Auroral Research Project in Alaska, the prototype of the ionospheric heaters at the super macro mega power level. In there, they talk about a book called The Lost Millennium by Walter and Lee Richman. He was a physicist at Princeton that wrote this novel because he couldn't share his ideas publicly because the JFK administration forced him to classify all his work because they saw it as so potentially dangerous. It'd be really interesting to learn what that was. But in his novel, he talked about how Atlantean scientist priests had created a technology, I think using crystals, that actually tapped into the energy of the sun and tried to draw down that energy to the earth to try to harness it, but it backfired. And so much of this energy came that it created sort of like an arc-weld torch of energy between the Earth and the Sun, and it burned up a vast part of this whole island or a continent and cracked the Earth's crust and made the continent sink, and it spun the Earth off its axis, and it was twirling around like a top. And so that was very interesting that he perceived and wrote this book back in the 1960s, that he could see the potential for something like this through ideas that he came about on his own work. And you know that stuff like that doesn't happen in a vacuum. This is when Gordon McDonald was at UCLA and Zbigniew Brzezinski was probably going to Hawaii with the Rockefellers and getting ready to create the Trilateral Commission. And it's also when Victor Klube and Bill Napier were doing some very interesting work. They're the two top comet researchers that I know of in the whole world. And actually, I was able to post hand-painted rocks to them last week because Duncan Steele, the comet astronomer who I interviewed, had a mailing address for Bill Napier in Ireland. So that was really, really cool. Hopefully those will get to him. In terms of the cometary impact thing, it was the Alvarez father and son team that got all the credit for the comet or asteroid impact that created the mass extinction event that got rid of the dinosaurs. This is the sort of the standard theory. But it was really Victor Klube and Bill Napier who did the original research, and actually, according to Duncan Steele, they actually communicated with Alvarez the year before they published their article in 1980 that had to do with the discovering the iridium layer around the world. But they're the ones that tipped Alvarez off to what had probably happened. But as Fred Watson said, the Alvarez team stole their thunder. So that's very interesting. But their hypothesis and model of what's going on is much vaster and larger cosmic context than Alvarez. Alvarez's team only talked about that one impact, which might have been what they call it, Chicxulub in the Yucatan in Mexico 65 million years ago. But the Klube and Napier talk about their legendary article on episodic bombardment. They talk about how that there's cycles of cometary impacts that varies over tens or hundreds of millions of years. And these peaks, and when the Earth and the Sun is passing close to an increased amount of comets and asteroids, that this has to do with the Earth and the whole solar system moving through different parts of the galactic arms. And when you look at the ice core graphs of the major climatological shifts that we believe that some of these ice core samples show, there's like big spikes that vary by quite a few degrees over, but they seem to be regular. They seem to be happening over the same span of time, however many hundreds of millions of years. And these climatic shifts could correspond directly to the movement of the Sun through these galactic arms. This is very, very interesting material. And it's also possible that even though Klube and Napier, as I understand it, didn't deal with electromagnetic aspects of comet or asteroid encounters or flybys, they probably dealt more purely with the mechanical and gravitational aspects. But when you add in the electromagnetic possibilities, that makes it even more complex and more interesting to understand what some of the effects might have been of a relatively close encounter between a rogue planet or a centaur or a comet or asteroid. It's really very, very, this is the stuff of geophysical research and speculation, but also weaponization, because I think that with the penetration of the military and the intelligence community into the university science departments, almost all the research that's going on, it's being funded or kind of guided either on the table or sort of behind the scenes so that the people are actually working on a weapons project, either how to weaponize processes of the Earth, part of the heliocosm, probably even beyond. You know, this would be the realm of sort of like the next generation of MK Ultra, how they can influence the scientific researchers and all the grad students and stuff like that to work on all these bizarre beyond science fiction level projects, and they think that they're just doing some basic science research because they don't see the master blueprint that the next echelon above them has that fits all their research together into this various components of a new strategic helio-geocosmic weapon system. I'm going to read a paragraph now. It's from a book called, I think it's called Towards the Year 2018, written in 1968. And I think I've got this whole book somewhere. But Gordon MacDonald, yes, the Gordon J.F. MacDonald that wrote the How to Wreck the Environment, his article is called Space. And here it is. By the year 2018, technology will make available to the leaders of the major nations a variety of techniques for conducting secret warfare, of which only a bare minimum of the security forces need to be appraised. One nation may attack a competitor covertly by bacteriological means, thoroughly weakening the population, though with a minimum of fatalities, before taking over with its own overt armed forces. Alternatively, techniques of weather modification can be employed to produce prolonged periods of drought or storm, thereby weakening a nation's capacity and forcing it to accept the demands of the competitor. So this is the blueprint that we're seeing with Australia. It's been under environmental warfare attack for decades. I mean, that's how Raytheon came to be able to set up shop at Woomera, and BAE Systems has been operating Jorn at Jindalee there, and all this stuff. This is part of a huge, huge, huge agenda, and the whole climate change thing has been nothing but a smokescreen for this all along, and it's been happening at exactly the same time. So Australia has been severely weakened by drought and by all these fires, the decimation of wildlife, spiritually the heart of the country, just torn because of the people's love for nature, and thousands of people dislocated and they're going to have to live somewhere else. And a lot of them won't be able to go back to their land, and it's just in the horrible, the smoke that's circling the whole world, and the stupid people here in New Zealand complaining that their glaciers got some ash on it. Oh my God, give me a break. But to put it all in perspective, I think that heliogeoterrorism is actually what we're witnessing in the world of today. I think that, this is from an email I sent earlier today about the explosions in the Earth's magnetic field. Yes, there are explosions in Earth's magnetic field. They happen all the time. That's a quote from the article. This is looking a lot like a next generation version of Project Argus, with possible explosions in the Earth's magnetic field being generated by HARP and sister transmitters. It's also sounding like the solar tap used by Atlantean scientists in Walter Richman's book, The Lost Millennium, quoted by Nick Begich and Gene Manning in Angels Don't Play This Harp. Of course, according to mainstream authorities, this is all happening because of solar wind anomalies, coronal mass ejections from the sun, natural phenomena. But this is part of the geophysical warfare engineering paradigm in two ways. One, the engineers constantly monitor what is happening, not only with the Earth, but heliocosmically. Then they are able to try to manipulate these energetic forces, capture them, redirect them, tap into them, harness them for experimental and or military purposes. In precisely the same way that Nikola Tesla built his lab at Ames, Colorado, above Telluride, where I used to live, so that he could harness lightning for experimental uses, as in that day, lightning was the only source of that level of electromagnetic energy. He chose that area because of the immense deposits of gold ore in the mountains there that gave the lightning unusually powerful characteristics. And two, to piggyback on or to learn how to use a CME, coronal mass ejection, for example, as a weapon system to take out a nation's power grid, for example, and make it look like another natural disaster. The geoengineering community and its distributed networks of university research departments are acutely aware of this kind of thing, as is the mining industry. I believe that even without the deliberate weaponization of the atmospheric, tectonic, and other processes of Mother Earth that Rosalie Bertell and the rest of us have documented through the cumulative summation of the effects of the global mining industry alone, not to mention the nuclear scenario and the global electrical grid, we have disrupted Earth's magnetotelluric processes to such a degree that it affects the magnetic fields and radiation belts, which have a lot to do not only with shielding the troposphere from cosmic rays and UV, but also has to do with how Earth interacts gravitationally and energetically with foreign objects moving within and or passing through the local solar system, comets, asteroids, and rogue planetoids. I've been doing a lot of research along these lines in recent years, and I just did an interview with comet and asteroid specialist astronomer Duncan Steele in Nelson 2 weeks ago. I know this sounds like science fiction, but I have come to learn that the real world is far freakier than any science fiction I've ever read. In 1996, I talked with Arthur C. Clarke on the phone twice about a lot of things. He was going to be a technical advisor for a project I was working on relating to the communication work with dolphins that I had been involved with. Clarke wrote the paper in 1946 that made satellites possible. Clarke contacted Steele in 1987 about a paper Steele published about the daughter fragments of a certain comet, which are believed to have been involved in numerous impacts and possibly ELEs, extinction-level events in Earth's history, prehistoric and proximal. And now a quote from the Lost Millennium. And the surge of power from the tap became an avalanche at the pole in the vertical plane of the planet's magnetic field, where the winds of magnetism would not rise to blow it out. 1 trillion watt seconds of energy unleashed their fury on the polar cap in the first flash. Even as it discharged, the ionosphere was recharged from the solar furnace. The first flash became a mighty roar that poured an increased and now steady stream of energy through the now stabilized short circuit. Kilocubit after square kilocubit of frozen wasteland boiled. Watt after watt of ever-increasing avalanche energy lit the polar cap with a glare that had never before been seen. A shockwave racing at the speed of sound, toppling great cities. Destruction continued for days, and the planet whipped about on its axis like a thing tortured. That sounds a lot like some of the stuff in the Old Testament that Emmanuel Velikovsky quotes in Worlds in Collision. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Please continue to send your prayers for all our family of life and all the koalas and the wallabies and the petty melons and potoroos and kangaroos and echidnas and platypus and wombat and all the goannas and the lizards and the butterflies and the honeybees and the white cockatoos and the black cockatoos and the emus and the lorikeets and the honey eaters and the butcher birds and the bowerbirds and the lyrebirds and the galahs and the corellas and the eucalyptus trees and the grass trees and the wattle trees and all the butterflies and the bumblebees and the worms and the turtles and the snakes and the lizards and everybody that's just in pain and suffering, all the untold countless numbers of our family of life, please send prayers for rain and prayers for healing for our species to stop waging war on Mother Earth. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Good day.
Yeah. What are you?